Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Blenders, and welcome to episode number 131 of Real Blend, a podcast that wants to know, Kevin, do you know Russell Crowe's favorite Alfred Hitchcock movie? Favorite Hitchcock movie.
All right, here's the thing, because I don't want to have dead air, yeah. I won't cheat. Can you give me a second to process it while you continue with the open?
Absolutely.
Okay with a dead air. I kind of just want to sit here and just think
also,
about it.
You're also on camera, so we know you're not cheating. So you can go ahead and do that, and I'll do plugs.
The first thing I went to was Crow and Birds.
Yes, but that's what it was.
Is it? That's it?
It is the Birds, yes. I went to the Birds.
Oh.
Disappointed?
That's fine. I was waiting for... I thought we were doing like an actual
Not a pun. He just loves the Birds.
Yeah.
It's an actual question and answer.
Oh, this show's going downhill fast.
Hi, my name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing director here at Cinema Blend, and I am joined by, as always, Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C., and Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hello, boys.
My man, it's nice to have Kevin back.
It is. Kev, we missed you last week.
It's nice to be back.
We freaked people out with Gabe being in the third chair.
No, that's all. I'm glad that Gabe got to fill in and everything. That's amazing. I think Gabe should be on the show more often, actually, but...
I feel like he's on it a little too much, as it is, to be honest with you.
I watched a bunch of old movies while I was gone, so it was cool.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Episode highlights. Speaking of old movies, Kev, they're doing an 80s reboot starring Kevin Hart and Will Smith. And if you haven't heard the news yet, we will tell you what it is in a minute. We are going to review Unhinged, hence all the Russell Crowe talk. And I want to get to plugs. So Real Blend has two YouTube channels. And in particular, we need you guys to go down and subscribe to them if you could. We're trying to boost those numbers a little bit. Get you guys watching the clip. So it's the show, essentially, on one of the channels, but you get to watch it on video. We record these episodes using technology that allows us to record ourselves doing it. I was going to say OBS, but nobody cares about that. I was going to get into really technical stuff. Using modern technology. And then we also have a new channel called Real Blend Clips, where we're pulling out segments from the show that make them easier for you guys to share. There'll be some times that we're going to run across in interviews where we get to ask spoiler questions, and we don't necessarily want to include it in the full-on interview, so we'll put them on the clip show. And so do us a favor, go over to the YouTube pages of both Real Blend and Real Blend Clips and give them a subscribe, turn on your notifications, and then that way we will continue to share great Real Blend content with you guys. Gabe, you're going to throw something in? You were leaning in? No?
Nope, I'm just here.
Excellent.
Just here.
Of course, get us wherever Real Blend podcasts are available, or any podcasts are available. And if you notice,
specifically
Real Blend. If you notice if you're watching the video, you can see that I have my DC Fandom hat. I want to really quickly plug that Cinema Blend is going to be doing a full court press for DC Fandom on Saturday, August 22nd. We're going to be covering it, all the panels that are happening for it, the movies and the TV panels. Of course, we'll probably talk about it on next week's episode as well, too, because specifically there will be one for Zack Snyder's Justice League. And as you can tell by my shirt, I'm very excited for that to come as well, too.
Book of sorts to read about it.
I keep saying that I'm about to drop this information, but the presale is technically it's available, but the page isn't like ready yet. But I think by today it's going to be ready, because we have the cover art image and they changed the subtitle of the book to be correct on the website. So very soon, you guys will be able to potentially pre-order the book that I wrote about the Snyder Cut. So.
Your shirt matches the colors of your shirt match the cover of your book
beautifully.
Such
right?
a great cover.
Synergy. This shirt is from something different. This shirt was on the animated Harley Quinn show that they have on DC Universe.
I heard that's great.
I have heard that too, and I haven't watched it yet. But the animators made a joke where they put two guys who were living in their mom's basement, sitting on a couch and arguing over comic book stuff. And the one guy had a Release the Snyder Cut t-shirt, and the other guy had a shirt that said episode 8 is underrated.
And, so it's you and Gabe.
Essentially, yes. And it was supposed to be a joke, like, oh, look at these guys. They're arguing with the Snyder Cut. But all the Snyder Cut people were like, that's amazing. Like, we want to own that shirt. So they made it, and then they put it up for sale for the Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and they raised money because of it.
Also, can we talk very quickly? I know we're, you know, I keep making this the Sean show, but can we talk about the fact that you have a Pop figurine now?
Oh, yeah. Well, let me wait till I can show that at some point, though, right?
Okay. Never mind. He doesn't have a Pop figurine yet.
I don't have it yet, but someone was, yeah, I don't, this is too much me. Someone was nice enough to make me a Pop figurine, and they're sending it to me, but it's really cool. He's got a Flash hoodie, and he's holding a little version of my book.
Which is fantastic.
And it's this girl, Cole, part of the Nerd Queens, and she actually designed the cover on a tiny little book that he's holding. So as soon as I have him, I'll bring him to one of the live episodes. So anyway, let's move on. Our weekly poll from last week, and Kevin, I'm going to throw this one to you, because it was part of our premium episode that we did recently, where we went over the Best Picture winners from 1995, which would be 94 films, which is something that we talked about a long time on this show, because we all love these other movies. This is the year the Forrest Gump won. So in the most recent premium episode of the show, and if you want to sign up for Real Blend Premium, please go to bit.ly/RealBlendPremium, Gabe? Yes? Gabe says yes. We asked everybody, which movie now, in hindsight, do you think would win? And I only gave them four choices, Kev. I didn't include Four Weddings and a Funeral. But so the four choices are, now, if you're saying which movie would win Best Picture for 1995, it's Pulp Fiction, Shawshank Redemption, Forrest Gump, or Quiz Show.
Would or should?
Well, should. Which one should win now? And so with having hindsight. So I want to hear your answer, and I also want to hear what you think the poll winner ended.
So just to clarify, the movie has still been out since 94, 95. Meaning that you're not saying it like it would have won if it came out today.
I think it's just the same question that we did on the premium. I think it's just 1995. People now deciding now.
Right.
Should
I just, yeah. I was clarifying just to make sure it wasn't like if the movies were released today, which one would win?
Gotcha. Gotcha. No. If they could redo the Oscars.
If they redid the Oscars this year for those films, I would say Pulp Fiction. But Shawshank is kind of creeping up there a little bit for me. I'm not really sure. I would say Pulp Fiction, though, just based on our listeners.
So the poll also went with Pulp Fiction, but Shawshank Redemption was very, very close. It was 46.5 to 37.7.
Wow.
I want to lament poor Quiz Show, which got 0.9% of the votes. So not even 1% voted Quiz Show. And I'm chalking that up to the fact that people just haven't seen it.
What did Forrest Gump get? I can't do math.
14.9%. Would still say that Forrest Gump deserved to win. So I don't know. If you want to find out what our choices were for that one, go back and listen to the most recent premium episode. And then we're recording another one today that we'll be posting on Monday. So all fun stuff to look forward to on the Real Blend podcast. All right, let's get to talking points. And we have two trailers that dropped right before we started recording the episode. The first one was for Kenneth Branagh's upcoming sequel, Death on the Nile, which I thought looked gorgeous. I really thought it was a well-cut trailer. It got me excited for the cast that he has. And I threw it out there that I thought it looked really exciting and enticing. Obviously, it's Branagh coming back playing Hercule Poirot. And Jake shot us back in the text chain. Meh. So explain. Why don't you elaborate on why Kenneth Branagh didn't win you over?
You know, I did enjoy the first one. I enjoyed Orient Express quite a bit. And I think a big part of it was just seeing that incredible cast together. This one, I just sort of feel like it kind of feels like the exact same movie without the stellar. I don't think the cast is nearly as good.
Gad and Daisy Ridley aren't there? Is that who you
are? Well, no. Like Johnny Depp and Michelle Pfeiffer and Judy Dench and Willem Dafoe.
Okay, fine. Okay, Point taken.
I just feel like it is a significantly lesser sequel. Like, if you'd had another incredible all-star cast on that ship, and also keep in mind the thing that, like, he's not even going to be on the ship when the murder happens. So he has to, show up after, because he's He's still on the train or getting off the train when he finds out there's been a death on the Nile, right? That's how Murder on the Orient Express ends. So he's not even going to be there when the murder happens.
I don't know if I necessarily, like, I don't remember those books. I read those books when I was a kid.
Well, basically. No, I'm not saying in the books, but in the movie, at the end of the movie, Murder on the Orient Express, like that, it was sort of a tease to the sequel. So he's going to show up after everything has happened.
And try to put it together.
Yeah. And I don't think the cast looks as good. It just doesn't seem as appealing to me.
See, I would argue it's the opposite, because the less famous faces in a movie like that, I feel like the more I would be immersed in it, depending on, you know, sometimes a lot of famous faces pop up and you kind of like get taken out. Like you look at something like Knives Out, for example, where Rian Johnson just made a great movie where you didn't really think about that much. But sometimes in these big films with these big casts, it's hard not to think about all the big stars you're watching on the screen. That being said, both the trailers that came out today were shot on film, which I know you guys make fun of me for saying that, but they were. And the 65 millimeter that he used on Death of the Nile looks insane. Like, you can actually see it in the trailer, how beautiful the film looks. I wish his aspect ratio was a little taller, but that's a whole other thing. But I do think that visually, the trailer looks incredible. I thought the song choice was not great. I didn't like the Depeche Mode song. I thought that kind of threw me off a little bit. It was a strange trailer choice.
What was the song in the first one? Didn't the first trailer
Imagine Dragons? Maybe?
Yeah, it was like they have a thing. Whoever cuts those, and the first time it would have been Fox, and it would have been Disney this time around. But they have a thing for taking songs and
I guarantee you, Brana chose it. I just feel like it doesn't tonally fit what the trailer was portraying leading up to the song starting. Yeah. I think it would have been more effective had it been more of a score heavy trailer. Yeah, but I mean, we've seen songs used in trailer really well when they manipulate them. I think one of the greatest trailer songs ever was Ready Player One, Take On Me, when they messed with Take On Me in the trailer.
I love that. I want to watch that movie again.
And so like, I find like, I don't know, to me that trailer song took me out. But then again, then you get back to the end. You see that amazing shot where he walks towards the boat and everyone is on the boat in line? Like, why are they moving like that? I wanted to ask, at the end of the trailer, why are they moving as if they're in some type of, like, organized line? Watch the end of the trailer again. It's a very strange shot. Like, you see Brana from the back. Also, one thing I found interesting about it was you could tell he learned a lot on Dunkirk. Because specifically with the boats and the way the boats look in the film, I got a very intent to like those boat shots that Nolan gets. I got a sense of that when I was watching it, because I mean, Brana shoots on the same cameras that Nolan uses, except for IMAX. So I think it's going to be gorgeous. The cinematography in that trailer is amazing. Gal Gadot looks amazing. I just didn't love the song. That's it.
Well, an actual boat. Like, it's full on sets.
Yeah.
It's, which I love also. And was this conversation? Oh, we were talking about this before the show. It looks weird to watch a trailer where people are interacting. I have a really hard time getting over this in this stupid
pandemic.
When
people shake hands, there's a moment of like, ooh, like people are shaking hands.
And there's dancing. There's like dancing and kissing. And I watch people in these trailers and I'm like, no, separate. Yeah.
We were talking about this before the show because Kevin's wife, Lauren, put out some incredible on-set interviews recently on YouTube.
She did.
You should absolutely check out.
DC and Film Girl.
Yes, and they're amazing, and they're doing incredibly well. And I was sort of joking how my gut knee-jerk reaction, and to no fault of hers, because it was filmed so long ago, but the shot is like a two-shot of her sitting next to someone, and my initial knee-jerk reaction was, oh, Lauren, what are you doing? Get away! Put on a mask, for God's sake!
I mean, it is weird. And then, like, but you're right, though. But then, Sean, I didn't have that problem after the trailer started, because there's something about the way he photographed the film that just immersed me in the moment. I blew the trailer up onto my MacBook full screen, and it's just, it looks awesome. I mean, if you go, I didn't love Murder on the Orient Express. Like, I know as much as Gabe and Sean, you did. I know you guys loved it. I liked it. But you can't deny the practicality of how he shot it. And now this is going to take that to a whole different level. I'm sure he has a bigger budget this time, because didn't Murder on the Orient Express make over $300 million worldwide?
It did really well, yeah.
It was one of those leggy movies that like didn't necessarily open huge, but like didn't drop week to week. Like it stuck around. I think it came out in November, if I remember right. And then just didn't go anywhere holiday season.
That's a strange one for me. Like if somebody asked, if I wasn't in like in our industry and I didn't look at box office numbers and someone said to me, how do you think Murder on the Orient Express did? I'd be like, I don't think anyone saw it. You know what I mean? Because I don't know a lot of people who saw the movie, but it did extremely well. Obviously enough for him to make a sequel. I don't know. Sean, you know the movie news better than I do. Was the sequel greenlit before the first one came out?
No. It definitely was after.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So he took a gamble by ending the first film that way.
And they just, Agatha Christie has a bunch of those, you know, Hercule Poirot novels that they could, if they wanted to franchise it, keep going. So they were probably wise to invest
in
that.
Greatest junkets of all time. Kevin and I got to ride the Orient Express from Venice to Paris and stay overnight. That's where the pun thing started.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, it started on
the Orient Express.
100%. No, he's 100% correct. There's no exaggeration. The puns that I do on this show, or we do on this show, started that day.
Well, tell the story now. I need to hear this.
It's not exciting, but we were sitting, we were on the train, which sounds crazy. And we were getting ready to interview Josh Gad in one of the train cars, which just sounds cool. And so the train's moving along and we're shooting an interview. Like, we're sitting next to him in a train car and they're filming us from like the bathroom. I think it was Jake.
Yeah.
Okay. And I don't know what it was, but I said something like stupid. Like, we should, I think he had just had a kid again or something. And I was going to say, you know, have you considered just changing your name to Josh Dad because you just had a kid?
And so for the next 36 hours, but we kept thinking of scenarios of like, man, like, I hope this interview goes well. Otherwise, he's going to be Josh Sad.
Yeah. And then Josh Bad.
Yeah. So the murder on the Orient Express was my spirit. That's what died that day.
That was the whole trip. So I think at one point it got to a point where like we'd be sleeping and I would say, hey, Jake, because I was in a bunk room. Jake, were you and I in this? No. I was in a room with Chris Van Vliet.
I was with Bebeda.
Jim from IGN, and he and at one point I think I said, hey Jake, you know Jake's favorite what did I say, his favorite cast member from Double Team, and it was like Jean-Claude Jake Hamilton. I can't remember how it went, but it was stupid. But
it got silly.
But it has lived on till this day.
It started on the Orient Express somewhere between Venice and Paris.
So we'll continue it with Death on the Nile. Okay, let's shift over to the other trailer that dropped today, which is Sofia Coppola's next film, On the Rocks, reteaming her with Bill Murray, obviously her Lost in Translation star, and also bringing in Rashida Jones. Full disclosure, I did not get a chance to watch this trailer before. So how did it look, Kev?
I loved it. But I also, again, I'm sorry to ring the film bell again.
That's
but
fine.
It can't be unwrung.
I remember interviewing her for The Beguiled, and we got into like a super deep conversation about shooting on 35. And also, if you notice, The Beguiled had a very tall aspect ratio, and this movie also does as well. So if you watch the trailer full screen, it's a large format shot. It's very Lost in Translation-y, I guess, if I would say. I mean, it's hard not to think about that because it's Bill Murray. But the comedy seems as dry. It seems like it feels like a Sofia Coppola, Bill Murray type of film. Okay. But the basic premise of it is Rashida Jones is the lead and her father is Bill Murray. Rashida Jones is married to Marlon Wayans, who I thought was a really great casting, because
I would love if he started getting a little bit more dramatic work
after Requiem for a Dream. Like, I wish he would have done more drama work, because his performance in Requiem for a Dream is, I think, the best thing he's ever done, next to Don't Be a Menace to South Central, which I love that movie and I think he's great in it, but from a dramatic standpoint he's brilliant in Requiem, which I really love that Sofia gave him another dramatic role, especially this is like an indie type film, so maybe Marla Wayans will start doing more indie dramas again, like Requiem. But the trailer is really cool. If you haven't seen it, don't turn it off when the title card hits, because they let the sound of Bill Murray's audio and dialogue continue through the slate and the release date, which I thought was a kind of a cool little thing. But I was really impressed with it. It looked really funny, and I love Bill Murray. I just feel like he only does stuff now that he really cares about, and you can tell he cares about it. So
I love Bill Murray too, but I also think Rashida Jones doesn't get enough credit. Like, she's amazing. Outstanding in everything that she does, but she's always like the second or third person in like Parks and Recreation or her stint on The Office for a little while. And when she shows up in movies, she is always outstanding, but doesn't really get all the credit that I think she deserves. So I love the fact that she's getting what looks to be a starring role.
And listen, and this is the only other thing I'll say about film and just the idea of like both these movies being shot on film this week. The reason I keep saying stuff like that is because we are living in an age where most filmmakers are shooting digitally because that's the easier route to go. Mm. And the fact that the reason I keep bringing it up every time we discuss films is that you should see a pattern here. all of the greatest directors of our time are still shooting on film. Mostly all of them. You know, Spielberg still shooting on film. Scorsese still shooting on film. Obviously, Sofia Coppola is. Brana is. Nolan is. Tarantino is. Abrams is.
Judd Apatow.
So I don't ever want to come across as like this film snob, this snooty guy. But that's, I just genuinely love the look of it. And I only mention it because I do feel that we're in a resurgence of film. I think that film and celluloid is coming back in a big way. And then when you have Nolan championing these massive IMAX film cameras, you're going to inspire younger filmmakers to come up and still work on film, which was why I was a little disheartened when Rian Johnson had to shoot digitally on Knives Out. Mm-hmm. And I know he was upset about that. Obviously, he said it in our interview on Real Blend. But I just wanted to say that I don't ever want to come across, oh, Kevin's being, you know, that film snob. But that's why I bring it up. I just think we're seeing more of it happen now. That's all.
And I
took
hope
you 131 episodes to be worried about that.
Yeah. No, I know. But I feel like, you know, sometimes when you have a not a crutch, but something that you say something and people go, OK, yeah, Kevin's going to say this. Kevin's going to say that, you know, whatever it would be. And I know those things become like, I love saying like you use a camera as a leading character in a film. I love saying that.
But we all have like our thing.
You know
we
what I mean?
Have, like, but we all have, like, I don't know about you, as I have questions that I lean on if I know that it's going to go well. And if it's a first particular circumstance, I if I know 100%. if it yields, ooh, that's a good question, 9 out of 10 times, like, hell yeah, I'm going to ask that. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
I know. I just feel like sometimes people do put people in boxes depending on what they say. And I just find it I just wanted to say that it's such a gigantic deal that we're still seeing, like, these two massive trailers that came out today were shot on film. Yeah. It's a big deal, man. It's a big
deal. Especially something like Death on the Nile, which is a massive production.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Know? Yeah.
And the fact he could still shoot that way was great. There was something that I think Charlie Kaufman said in Jake's interview, which really broke my heart, which you were asking about the adaptation. Did you ask? Okay, I have to make sure that it was yours that I watched and maybe not Eric's. But he basically confessed, he was like, part of the reason why I went forward was this because I just thought I could get the budget to make it.
No, that wasn't mine.
Oh, that wasn't yours?
Well,
he got asked about whether, you know, why he wanted to pursue this adaptation. And he essentially just admitted, like, this seemed like a project that I could get the funding for. And that made me really sad to hear him sort of phrase it that way. And I think it's realistic. You know, I think that that's a really, he's speaking from the perspective of the business is giving him the chance to make this movie because it's semi low budget. It takes place mostly in a car for the most part. So when he phrased it that way, and because you talk about, you know, film being as a budget that people have to sort of account for if they're going to use film, these are the realistic situations that are facing filmmakers nowadays.
And Kaufman shot 35, and obviously, when people see it on the film, it's a 1:3:3 4:3 ratio. So you have the black bars and the.
I noticed that. I was proud of myself. I was like, this looks like a box.
Exactly, and it was like, the reasoning for it, if you watch the trailer, is it's meant to make you feel claustrophobic. So as you're watching the film, since you're in the car a lot of the film. But it's interesting when you watch the movie, he uses the camera in a very leading way. And to go to your point, Sean, I asked him about, you know, the ratio and shooting on film and things like that. And he basically admitted to me that he didn't have enough time. He didn't mention funding, but he wishes he could have done more stuff with the camera, which goes kind of against a little bit what you just said, where he said, like, oh, I wish I could have got the funding. I did it because I got the funding for it. But he made it sound like in my interview that he didn't have enough time and or money to do all the stuff he wanted to do. So that's interesting. Yeah.
I wonder with these Netflix budgets, you know, that they're going to turn that spigot off eventually.
I had a question that I asked him that I was really excited about because obviously, like, he's attempted to adapt a book before with The Orchid Thief and he couldn't do it. And we ended up getting adaptation out of it, which I think is a brilliant way to tell that story about how the fact that he couldn't tell that story. So my question was, like, what in the adaptation process of this novel, like, would make for a good story or would make for a good movie since you did that last time? And he kind of went like, nothing. And it was, like, it was really boring. And I was like, oh, okay.
I got one of those too. So it's funny. So Kaufman was really cool and I really enjoyed the interview, but, like, he doesn't BS around anything. If he doesn't
but he's
have
done
an
speaking,
answer,
he's done speaking.
And so, the title of the film, the word of is italicized, right? If you look at the title of the film.
And everything's lowercase.
Everything is lowercase. And then the of the title is italicized. Everything else is normal. So I asked him why that was. And he said, I have no idea. I'm like, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said he had no, it was not his idea. There was no thematic meaning for it at all. Just the artist put it on the poster that way.
What?
I'm like, but it's your movie. How do you
I would think he would have something to do with that. Because so, whenever I saw all the entire thing was in lowercase, my first thought was like, oh, that's such a Kaufman thing.
No, you know who designed it? The guy who turned Avatar into Papyrus.
Dude, that is one of my all-time favorite SNL sketches.
It's so great.
The Gosling. Like, I know what you did.
I actually watched it recently. And it's so funny.
It's so random. Sean, did you see the Kaufman movie?
I watched the first 10 minutes of it the other night. And I had just watched Bill and Ted Face the Music. And then we finished that and I looked in my Netflix queue and it was there. And I thought, okay, cool. I'm going to start it. But it was like 10 o'clock on a Friday.
Oh yeah. That's
not late, but like I realized in the first 10 minutes that this movie needed all of my attention. And so I was like, I got to punch out. Yeah. I cannot wait until
the three of us talk about that movie. I've watched it twice now.
Yeah, oh, so no kidding.
There's Jake, then you'll find this funny. This is a little piece of movie trivia that I found out only because I brought it up to Jesse Plemons and Jesse Buckley in the interview. So Jake, since you've seen the film, and this is also in the trailer, this is not a spoiler. You know, there's the moment where they walk up to that frame in the house and it's the younger photo of, and for the first two times you see it, it's his face.
It's hers. She thinks it's her. And she goes, a picture of me. And then he looks at it and goes like, no, it's me. And then it's him.
Right. So apparently they got the photos from their family and that's Jesse Buckley's body for the entire photo. And it's Plemons' head on her body. So when you watch the film, that's just funny.
I want to go look that up in the trailer now.
So when you watch the film, when you look at that picture, it's you'll see Plemons' face on Buckley's body. And it's not noticeable, but I just thought that was really interesting that he did
that.
That's
funny.
I want to call Jake out on that too, because Jake follows up that interview question with Charlie Kaufman is like, so we're not getting an adaptation sequel?
I did ask that.
And he took it very seriously. Yeah. He was like, no.
No, because it was like a joke. Like, it was meant to be like, oh, okay, so like...
So then your tweet, you were like, we talked about, and your second thing you put was like, adaptation sequel, ?!
Well, I did, and the answer is no.
You still asked it.
I watched it, I looked at your tweet, and I was like, oh, I can't wait till people listen to the clip to get to it. All right, let's get to a remake that's coming down.
Thanks for ruining the clicks on my YouTube channel.
I love the behind the scenes things like that. For whatever reason, they are going to try to remake one of my favorite films of all time, which is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And in place of John Candy and Steve Martin, we are going to get Kevin Hart and Will Smith. Two fantastic actors who I genuinely like in just about everything that they try to do, but there is no need for this whatsoever.
Yeah.
This speaks to the concept of when we're remaking things, it'd be better to try to remake stuff that didn't work the first time through to try to improve it or to look at a different angle. But I really don't see any way to improve on John Hughes's classic.
Maybe his best movie.
Arguably.
Breakfast Club.
And I love Ferris, though. I really do love Ferris. And Breakfast Club is tremendous.
I prefer Planes, Trains to Ferris and Breakfast Club.
Do you really? All right, so there you go. Yeah. So I think I've mentioned this on the show before, and then Jake made fun of me for it being so sad. This was my tradition. Every night, or every year, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, I get a bottle of Captain Morgan's and a six-pack of Coke, and I sit in front of the television and I watch Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, because there's a reason. One year, when PJ was an infant, he wasn't quite one. He was born in February, so this is the following November. We tried to go up to New York to visit my family for Thanksgiving, and it was the most hellacious experience trying to travel. First holiday traveling with an infant, everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. And in that moment, there was one time we got stuck in Washington, D.C. because we had a connecting flight and we had about 6 hours in the terminal in between flights with an infant again. And we got onto the plane and we pulled that away from the gate and Michelle fed PJ and he fell asleep in her arms. And we thought, great, 1 hour flight, we'll get up to New York. So he slept for an hour, and for that 1 hour, the plane never moved. It stayed on the runway and didn't taxi, didn't take off. And the minute the plane started to move, he woke up and cried for the next hour and 15 minutes. And at that point, I turned to Michelle and I said, we will never, ever, ever travel for a holiday again. And for 16 years now, we have not traveled for a holiday. We have stayed in North Carolina for Christmas and Thanksgiving. And I say to my family all the time, I'm like, I'm sorry, we're just never going to do it.
You do realize that they can fly now without crying.
No, it's fine. I'm not going to do it. So my tradition from that moment on was to sit. So I watch. Oh, this is why you made fun of me. I watched the Weather Channel before I turn on Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, because they do live looks at all the airports. And I drink my rum and coke and I say, look at those dumb sons of bitches trying to travel on the holiday, because they check in on all the airports and they're like 5-hour delays. At so
that's
O'Hare like a horrible
that's
weather.
That's a good day for you.
It's one of my favorite days of the year is to sit there and drink and watch the Weather Channel.
Bad
and then
day
I finish
for you.
Off real blend day. Show day. Show day, essentially. So anyway, they're remaking this movie that I consider to be a stone cold classic. Do either of you think this is a good idea?
No. I mean, like, you know, the thing is to, like, I mean, you look at Will Smith's career trajectory in the early 2000s, like, he should be pretty close to being an Oscar winner by now. But instead, like, his last five movies are Bad Boys 3, a movie where he played a pigeon.
Hey, Bad Boys 3 is awesome.
Yeah,
still
but
the
like,
highest grossing movie of the year.
He was a pigeon in Gemini Man?
No, he did the pigeon movie,
kidding,
right?
I'm kidding.
That's what you weigh in on, Gabe? Gemini Man, what else did he do? Aladdin? Like what is he doing?
Okay, so it's a little bit Tom Cruise syndrome, where Tom Cruise for a little while...
No, Tom Cruise makes good movies.
Well, I'm saying he went for the awards pedigree drama for a little while, and now he's going to save franchises for his most recent stint. I mean, what has he done that's not Mission Impossible? He did the Doug Liman film where he was the drug runner.
Sure, but like the Mission Impossible films are quality films. They're better than the Bond movies.
Edge of Tomorrow is a masterpiece.
Yeah, very true.
Edge of Tomorrow is top it's 10 phenomenal. Cruise. Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
top
yeah.
five. Top five Cruise, maybe.
Ooh, now you're getting... that's hard.
What's top five Cruise?
Rain Man. Few Good Men.
Jerry Maguire.
Okay, personal. Everyone give their personal five. All right, go ahead, Sean. Because I wouldn't have any of those in mind.
Really?
No. Wait. My cruise list.
I'm
is
actually
much...
gonna take. I'm gonna take the time.
Are we doing this right now?
Yeah, we're doing it.
We're doing it, Gabe. You got somewhere to be?
Well, here you guys do this while I say my two cents on Planes, Trains.
Oh, okay. Please do this. Okay.
My biggest concern, because this is, I think
we're doing this.
We're really doing this right now.
My biggest concern is this is ripe for the, like, let's take beats and moments from the original and then add, like, how technology has changed that. Like, I'm waiting for, like, a self-driving car joke or, like, a cell phone joke. Like, it feels like it's going to be that, like, late 2000s, early 2010s.
Yeah, and so much of what
they were
is
just making
great,
jokes about, like, hey, now we have a phone.
So much of what's great about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is how just normal stuff doesn't go in their favor, like renting a car or, you know, a plane getting delayed, and that's just not as entertaining. The original Planes, Trains, and Automobiles also has the funniest, I'm not going to say the funniest, but one of the funniest jokes I've ever heard, which is when they're driving on the wrong side of the road. And the couple yells at them across the way and says, you're going the wrong way, to tell them that they're driving into oncoming traffic. And John Candy turns around and says, how do they know where we're going?
that movie.
So simple.
Sean, that movie and oh my gosh, why am I blanking on this? The movie that I just watched the other day with John Candy and Blues Brothers. Those are two of the greatest comedies ever made. Like they
terrific.
Blues Brothers still puts me into tears. And I only bring that up because John Candy's in both, but all right.
Can I point out that you guys have somehow turned a movie with John Candy into a top five list of Tom Cruise somehow?
This is classic real blend.
I got my five. Somehow we brought Tom Cruise.
Okay, right, do you want to start at five and then go down?
I don't have them ordered. I don't have them ordered.
I've got mine ordered.
Just pick the five that you pick.
All right,
Kevin, you got it? Go for it.
Go ahead. These are my personal five top five favorite Tom Cruise.
Let's see how many we have crossover.
Now, wait, did we do performances or movies?
I'm doing movies.
I just did a movie that he's in. Yeah,
perfect. Mm-hmm. All right, here's my five. Vanilla Sky.
Mm-hmm.
Tropic Thunder.
Okay.
Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry Maguire and Minority Report.
Oh, I have three of those.
I have two of those.
I have Minority Report. I have Ghost Protocol. I have Jerry Maguire.
Then Ghost Protocol specifically?
Ghost Protocol specifically,
nice.
Yes.
Nice. All right, cool.
Yes. Then I also have Few Good Men and Rain Man.
Okay.
I have Jerry Maguire. I have Minority Report.
Oh,
Fallout.
Okay.
A Few Good Men and Collateral.
Yeah.
Terrific. If Collateral was shot on film.
The what?
By default, does that make Minority Report Real Blend's favorite Tom Cruise?
I guess it does.
I guess it does.
Because it was on all your...
Wait, did we not all do... Sean, you didn't do Jerry Maguire?
I did do Jerry Maguire. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll save that for another episode.
That's a really great one.
If only really Michael Mann shot Collateral on film. That's the only thing.
I like the cold digital look of it.
Move on, I know, because we are. Kevin, I don't know if you know this, but Snyder's cut of Justice League, he's maintaining the IMAX ratio aspects.
The 1.431, the 70 millimeter. Yeah, dude, BVS in 70 mil IMAX was unbelievable. So I'm all
so awesome.
I know, it's great.
Thank you.
All right, Kevin and Jake both saw Lovecraft Country, the premiere. I have not had a chance to see it. Do you guys recommend it? Are you going to stick with
it? Yes. It's just, I would say it's a bit of a slow burn character build at first. I think the first episode is 70 minutes. And it's probably the last, I don't know, Kevin, what would you say, 20, 25 minutes before you sort of realize what the show's going to be. I hadn't really seen any trailers other than just sort of knowing who was involved. And I felt like, well, Lovecraft's name is on it. Therefore, there has to be some sort of supernatural element to it. And but what's fascinating to me about this show is that it's about horrors and monsters and things that go bump in the night, but it is scary long before the monsters ever show up. It is three African Americans who are driving through America in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. So they come across real monsters long before they ever come across fictional monsters. And to me, that is sort of what I'm interested in seeing the show explore more. Is like, yes, there are in this world like monsters out there, but there are just people that are even scarier. And that's what really fascinates me. And I think it's going to be a really interesting theme that I hope that they keep following. And I am sucked in 100%.
Yeah, it's like when you watch Get Out, like racism was the monster. Racism was the villain in Get Out. And I think that what Jake brings up is there's a specific scene in the first episode where a police officer has the characters make a U-turn. And it's horrifying. It's like it's such a simple scene, but it's so terrifyingly done. And to Jake's point, it's all about that idea of that person is a genuine monster. But as the episode progresses, I did like how everyone, I won't give anything away, but the end of the episode does bring some bridges together, which I thought was a really interesting way to look at it. The show starts extremely sci-fi, which I thought was a really smart move. The first scene, right? Like that battle scene, Jake, specifically.
Yeah.
That's how the show starts.
Yeah.
Jurnee Smollett-Bell and Jonathan Majors and Courtney B. Vance are phenomenal. I have yet to see Michael K. Williams show up on the show specifically. Yeah. He plays the father.
Oh, man, that's a great cast.
Great cast.
And I'm telling you right now, like, you know, Michael K. Williams, he might be one of the greatest actors working today. I mean, he's just amazing. I saw the first season of The Wire, so I loved him in that. But I think he's just brilliant. But the show is, like Jake said, it's like it's that duality of monsters, which is really fascinating. The last 15 minutes are so blood soaked insane.
Oh, wow.
Like, I was blown away. Like, the show just becomes hyper violent in this instant, and it becomes a monster show, literally a monster show. It kind of reminded me of like the duality of From Dusk Till Dawn, when From Dusk Till Dawn starts off as a different kind of a genre. It's a, you know, the two guys are on the run from the police, and it turns into a horror film, like a monster film. But like to Jake's point,
that's an interesting comparison.
Yeah, theoretically there were monsters, you know, I guess you can say that Seth Gecko, the characters that Clooney and Tarantino played, were monsters, right?
So yes,
yeah, it's interesting.
Definitely the character Tarantino played.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Which, by the way, I rewatched that the other day, and I don't mean to be a tangent, but to what Jake just said is very interesting to me, because Jake, I had a very weird feeling in my stomach the other day when I was watching From Dusk Till Dawn. So for people who haven't seen From Dusk Till Dawn, there's a scene where they capture this bank teller, a woman, and they put her in a trunk and they drive her to a motel, which is where they meet the Harvey Keitel and Juliette Lewis characters. And Clooney's character leaves the hotel and leaves Quentin Tarantino in the hotel, and he does something absolutely horrific to this woman. We don't know what it is. It's disturbing. I would assume.
I mean, he says
kind of says it.
Clooney, yeah, Clooney says, because Clooney says, like, these are the things we do not do, and he lists.
Right.
And that, to me, that implies that because you do that, I'm telling you we don't do that.
Right. And so what's fascinating about that scene is that's an interesting moment where you have two villain characters and one becomes the more likable.
Because Clooney comes back with a burger for her.
Yes. And so Clooney's still a bad guy, technically speaking, for what
he's
been
doing. But
he bought
her a cheeseburger.
He's been killing
people. A big kahuna burger.
Right. But what's his line? I don't kill people that I don't have to. Like, remember that line?
So I've got five little friends, and they can all run faster than you can.
Yeah. And so for me, just the point you just made was something that just kind of struck me because I rewatched it recently. But that is a fascinating development when two characters can weigh out how nasty the other one is.
Well, Clooney has a great line at the end that I think sort of sums up the point you're trying to make, and it might be the last line of the movie where Juliette Lewis is trying to go with him and he says no, and he goes, I may be an asshole, but I'm not a fucking asshole. And I think that sort of sums up, that's a great line. And I think like that sort of sums up the difference between the two of them.
Good. And then there's that wide ending
and
shot.
That song that plays.
Yeah. That movie is so incredible. If anybody out there hasn't seen it, and it's also great because Tarantino is one of the stars of the movie. Yeah. He's like the lead.
It's fun
in the
to
film.
Watch I've only been able to do it a few times because I don't know a ton of people that don't know what that movie is, but it's fun to watch that movie with someone that doesn't know what it is and to look at their face whenever it turns it from one movie into another.
Yeah. Did you ever watch Full Tilt Boogie? The documentary. Mm-hmm. So back when that movie came out, see, Gabe knows what I'm talking about. When the DVD came out from Dusk Till Dawn, it was a 2-disc flip. And it had a second movie in it called Full Tilt Boogie, which is like an hour and a half documentary about the making of From Dusk Till Dawn.
Oh, I'd love to see that.
It is
amazing. Oh, dude,
amazing.
You have to watch it.
I was obsessed with it.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's a great behind the scenes documentary, but there are so many instances where you see Tarantino and Rodriguez just sitting next to each other
and
talking
Nicotero.
About creating the story. Yeah. There's a whole segment in it with Clooney and Tarantino's like assistant, like personal assistants, and they follow them around and talk about what they do on set and like how they it's a cool behind
I'd
the scenes.
I'd love to see that. That's fantastic.
Yeah. I recommend it.
And also a phenomenal Michael Parks performance in that movie as well.
Oh my God, the opening scene. Oh, Michael. And what's it? Who's the guy behind the counter
from the Sessions? John Hawks.
John Hawks. He's
John
fantastic.
Hawks, that's right.
Great actor.
I never said
help us.
What's funny about that scene is I always loved because Rodriguez is such a raw filmmaker. And I love how he had the popcorn continue popping as he was on fire going into the popcorn, and it was just like he always played with sound effects so interesting.
Well, and I'll really quick just tell this story, and I know Gabe's saying wrap it up, but I mean when we went to the Alita Battle Angel said visit in Austin, and the Kansas bar in that movie is the Titty Twister from Dusk Till Dawn.
That's crazy.
And they had a opening night party. This was when Alita was kicking off South by Southwest, but not the movie, but they just brought everybody out to Troublemaker Studios in Austin. And he essentially had Iron City, which is from Alita, built essentially. And it's like from the ground up till about 10 feet for all these buildings, and then everything above it would be green screen from that point on. And we walked into the Kansas bar and they were like, yeah, we're going to have the drinks and we're going to do junket interviews in the replica of the Kansas bar. So everybody who went to, when you were on deck, you were just hanging out at a bar. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those situations where a movie is so integral to you growing up that I'm looking around the location and I'm saying, this is the Dusk Till Dawn bar. Like I'm sitting in the Dusk Till Dawn bar. So when I got a chance to interview Rodriguez, I was like, tell me that this isn't the same place. And he goes, oh, yeah, it totally is. The same set. We just flipped it. He goes, so from when in Dusk Till Dawn, the staircase was over on this side and the bar was here. We just reversed it so that it didn't look the same. He goes, but it's the exact same bar. I've kept it this entire time.
So that bar is in
Troublemaker in Austin. And it's also the bar that they used for the Alita set.
So that's wild.
Doesn't he tell that story on our podcast interview that we did with him?
He might.
I think he
God,
does.
I forgot he was on the podcast.
Because we interviewed him. Because Jake, I remember you were at the junket. And
yeah, it was weird. We're like, I had to be in a different room. He and I were both at the same place, but I had to be in one room and he had to be in another. Old memories.
What was that for?
Alita.
Oh, that was for Alita.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
America, we are endowed by our creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. To serve others in ways that promote human flourishing and create a ripple effect of transformation for generations to come. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Okay, anyway, this week in movies, let's get to reviews of things that are actually opening. We'll start with Amazon Prime's film Chemical Hearts, and you guys did the junket for it. So what do we know about it? Is it worth checking out?
Yeah, hello. So it's Lily Reinhart. Lily Reinhart produced the film, executive produced the film.
Good for her.
And yeah, I like her a lot, actually. She's really, she's very open about depression and mental health, and I've always appreciated like seeing that in her social media and things like that. But yeah, the film is...
She's from Riverdale. She's mainly known for that?
Plays Betty on Riverdale. Concept of the show is basically her character got into a really bad car accident where something bad happened within the nature of the accident. It left her severely injured, her leg specifically, so she walks with a stick. And so she's in school, and I think they're writing for the newspaper at the school, and she meets this other kid played by Austin Abrams. Is that his last name? And he's from Euphoria. And they both just connect over... being, you know, with depression and anxiety and things like that. It's kind of like a Fault in Our Stars vibe. And again, I'm not comparing it in regards to thematics, more of just like the vibe of it, the tone of it just feels like there's comedy mixed in with like very serious drama. But as we're taken through a younger romance, it's I mean, I haven't finished the film. Admittedly, I've not watched the whole thing because I was watching it this morning prior to my interview. But she was wonderful. I'm a big fan of her. She's nice.
Very nice. There's a movie coming to Netflix.
That's not really a movie review.
Amazon Prime.
But I'm saying there's a movie coming to Netflix called The Sleepover, which we haven't seen yet.
Who's in that?
Gabe? Isn't Malin Ackerman in it?
Lauren did interviews for that. Whenever she posts them, I'll plug it here. It's DC Film Girl. I think she interviewed them.
We have a movie coming to VOD called Tesla, which also has some pretty big people in it.
Is Ethan Hawke.
Ethan Hawke and Kyle MacLachlan. I believe that it's getting pretty good reviews. None of us have seen it yet. We did see Unhinged, Russell Crowe's film. No? I've heard it described as falling down, but like without an ounce of humor to it at all. Is it really, really intense and really somber?
It's brutal, man. It's just brutal. I just did not find it to be enjoyable to watch. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this whole idea of what happens when the wrong guy has a bad day. It starts as just sort of kind of a little bit of a misunderstanding in traffic that just snowballs kind of, for me, beyond the point of believability. Like, whenever I watch Falling Down, I fully believe that could happen on a random day in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. This movie, it about the halfway point, I sort of went like, okay, like there would be a full... court movement of a police force to find this guy and stop this guy. It wouldn't get to this point. It crossed a threshold, and like I said, just the brutal and just the cold brutal nature of it of Russell Crowe's character and some of the things, the actions that he performs, it just wasn't fun. And granted, like, I can watch a violent film and still have fun watching it. I didn't enjoy, like, I was looking forward to it being over. I did not enjoy watching this movie.
Kev?
So I have an interesting, different take on it, but I agree that it's not enjoyable. I thought it was an interesting, see, Falling Down is a good example, but Falling Down is different because Michael Douglas's character is, when we meet him and when we learn about him initially, he is not a bad person. He just breaks, right? And kind of whatever goes down. That's why the end of Falling Down is so dramatic with him and Robert Duvall. And it's like, you know, because you don't really want him to die. I mean, like, I don't think we go through Falling Down hating him. I think we go through Falling Down going, oh, man. Like, I feel like everybody, you know, again, no one's going to pull out a gun in a Burger King because breakfast ends in 5 minutes and they're not going to serve it to him. But, people think about those types of things, like when you're in traffic, oh my God, I'm going to kill somebody, or, you know, whatever it is. It's just like thoughts you never act on kind of thing. So this movie starts and the character has zero redeemable qualities. He starts off in one of the darkest positions you could ever start off in. I mean, I won't give anything away. I don't think this is in the trailer, but something horrific happens involving him in the beginning of the film before we get to the traffic stop moment, the honking of the horn. I think what makes this film scary is that the character has absolutely zero goodness in him. Not one ounce of him is good. So that's an unstoppable force who doesn't care if he gets caught. Doesn't he say something along the lines of, I don't care if a cop or pulls me over and shoots me dead?
He says I think he says like suicide by cop is a good option or something
right.
like that.
This guy does not care. All he cares about is making an example of what a bad day is for somebody. He wants to show somebody how bad your day can be.
That's terrifying.
So right. So if you think about it from a horror perspective, it's very Duel-esque. Spielberg's Duel mixed in with like a falling down quality to it. I'm with Jake a little bit. There's just some scenes where like there's a scene in a diner with when she's on the phone with a friend of hers that seemed a little like, okay, all right, someone would have done something. But that being said, think about it. If you're sitting in a diner and see someone murder somebody, I don't know how people would react in that situation. But as you watch the film, you buy into the craziness because this guy doesn't care what happens to him. Okay, so that to me makes him a terrifying villain, you know?
I would make the argument that, I mean, like with Duel, the reason I love Duel is like, you don't really know about the truck driver and it's not played by an Oscar winner. It's just like sort of this terrifying force. It really kind of, he ended up repeating with Jaws and sort of just kind of this, it kept going. I feel like if you're going to have Russell Crowe play that part, then you got to give him like, I need, and he throws out some lines about his wife divorcing him and kind of screwing him over in the divorce. That kind of sort of in his mind justify.
Does Crowe sell it?
Crowe is amazing. I was all in on his performance.
I almost wish it were like Duel, like where like it wasn't played by an A-list Oscar winner and it was just this guy in a truck that was ticked off. Like I because it was played by Crowe, it was fun seeing him do some of those things because it's him, but I expected, because it's him, there to be more to the character. Like, there's not. He's just, like, to your point, he's just a bad guy who got pissed off in traffic,
right?
And that's it. And I would have liked, if that's all there's going to be, then I'd almost wish there were less for it to be a little bit more mysterious and therefore not played by Russell Crowe. I wish it had just been a guy in a truck.
See, I have a different question.
Just one quick thing on that. Just one quick thing. I didn't mind him being a flat performance. He's just evil for the hour. I mean, it takes place essentially in real time, basically, right?
It's not a bad performance. I mean, he's like good in it. I just don't think the character is good enough for him.
I think what made me like the film, and again, I didn't love this film, but I liked it enough because it genuinely freaked me out. But here's the thing. We can all agree on this. We've all been in a situation where you're behind somebody, you honk at them or they honk at you, then you end up at the next light again together.
And it's so awkward. It's so cringeworthy.
Weird look over and you know it's going to be weird. So it taps into a realistic thing that we've all been through. On top of it, you put a performer who's one of the greatest actors of our time, who just nails the performance. Script-wise, fine. Some of the dialogue, fine.
Bad dialogue.
But what made me scared the most, Jake, was as I watched it, I was attracted to the screen in the hope that he would turn slightly good. So it's almost as if, like, yes, he's flat bad the whole movie. But if you watch it from the perspective of the hope that he might just go, all right, I need to stop doing this. What am I doing to this whole family? But he doesn't. I'm not going to say anything specifically about the storyline, but he doesn't ever give you that. And I think that's what makes the character great, because he's just confident in his horror elements, you know?
I have a question about it. And this has been one of the films that's been adamant about playing in theaters. Like, it really wants to be one of the first movies that you come back to theaters to see. Does it demand that element? Do you think it benefits from seeing
it? I would have rather seen it in theaters.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you the exact scene that I watched that I said I wish I was in a theater.
I bet I know what it was.
Was it the growling of the truck?
Oh, I was going to say it was when the truck plows through the cop car.
That's a great scene too, but early on in the film, when this is actually in the trailer, when you see when you see him, the moment of the honk.
Yeah,
there's this amazing sound design that they did where they went from this cheap car that the lead actress was driving, this like, you know, cheap sounding motor, not cheap, but it just didn't sound like it was like had a lot of weight to it. Then you pop back to Crow and you just hear the rumble of his truck. And I was like, if we were in like a Dolby or an IMAX, you would get that full,
and it would like move around the theater.
And again, it's and I'm not saying this because, you know, you guys all know we're theater advocates on this show, but there's something when you're watching a movie at home and your brain goes, oh man, that moment would have been cool in theaters.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
sure.
It's really kind of sad, but that I'm going to pay to see Unhinged. I'm actually going out to a movie theater tomorrow for live shots.
Me too.
Yeah. Now, are you going? They won't let me go in. Are you going to go
in? They're letting me go, not for the morning show, but they're letting me go in for my noon.
In the afternoon.
Yeah.
But they won't let me. Our movies don't start until 2:45 here.
Ours start at noon, but I'm a little surprised that, like, you would think if I, because I'm going to an AMC. Are you going to an AMC?
Yeah, I'm going to an AMC.
You would think that, like, AMC would be trying to get any and all press.
Yeah. I thought the same thing.
The fact that they're like, well, like, there's not going to be anyone there, so you can't come in, but you're welcome to do live show. I'm like, don't you guys need help? Like, don't you guys need people to come to your... You're not going to... Like, not to be like a jerk, but yeah, they should be, like, happy that we're going to do live shots.
I thought the same thing. I'm going out there tomorrow morning to do live shots, and you're talking about people who want to send people to your location. And I mean, I get it. I'll be out there at 6 a.m. There's going to be anyone there. But if you look at the movie times of the theater I'm going to tomorrow, they're sold out all day. Black Panther sold out. Goonies is sold out. They're all sold out, like 30% capacity.
Theaters are open by you guys.
Tomorrow. Well, tomorrow AMC theaters open up. And tomorrow being Thursday, August 20th.
Yeah. Okay. And I sent Gabe a text last week. I think I bought my first movie ticket last week. I was supposed to go see Inception Friday night at 8:30 in IMAX so I could see this featurette that came out about Tenet, which is not online yet, but my parents are coming up, so I can't go now. So my first movie back, I'm gonna make it, hopefully, Tenet. But in this featurette, and we didn't do the show last week, I don't know if you guys read the way they shot the action forward and backwards.
Yes.
Like, oh my God. I assumed that was some trickery in edit, that especially the actual forward motion and backward motion of maybe an explosion or an action. But the fact that he did it for real that way is nuts. But and no green screen, 280 VFX shots. It's crazy.
To quote Kevin McCarthy, we're not ready for this.
We're not ready.
No, I really don't think we're ready. And I don't say that jokingly. Part of me wonders,
get your ass ready, man.
I don't know that our brains are ready to comprehend what we're about to experience.
I have a big question without revealing anything that we're not supposed to already know. I have a question for you guys.
Oh.
By the time we record the next episode of Real Blend, will we have seen Tenet?
I don't know. I mean, it doesn't open here until September 3rd, right?
Seems ridiculous to say yes to that, but knowing how last minute things happen in our lives, it's possible.
Okay, let me ask you this. The international junkets are happening as we speak. Does that mean some people have already seen it?
Yes. Oh, people saw it Monday.
Okay, I'm gonna say yes. Then by the next episode of Real Blend, I believe we will have seen Tenet. Gabe.
Yeah. The movie screened Monday.
We're gonna just spoil everything
also,
for you, brother.
I want to say this. I think Christopher Nolan. You guys already know I think Christopher Nolan's a genius, but I think he's a marketing genius as well. So he adds Travis Scott to his soundtrack. So Travis Scott's doing a song.
I thought of
soundtrack.
You when I saw that.
And it's an interesting choice, but if you think about it from the perspective of audience, so you put Harry Styles in Dunkirk. Dunkirk is going to make already a lot of money, but all of Harry Styles fans are going to go see it. You have Travis Scott tweet out a photo of the song cover that he's doing for
Tenet.
Which
is so cool.
With John David Washington like falling in midair. And it gets 100,000 favorites on Twitter.
Yeah.
So like, I'm telling you right now, and I think that move, that Fortnite thing, I know all that stuff was weird, but think about the audience he's reaching. He is about to, if he can get 12, 13, 14-year-old kids to go to a 70mm IMAX of Tenet and learn about actual film projection, That's a big deal. That I take all of that as a win. I know Fortnite's weird, but I love that it's out there like that, you know?
All right, really fast. Give me thumbs up, thumbs down, one and only Ivan.
I liked it a lot. I liked it a lot.
Yeah? And yeah. Cutthroat City. Go with theatrical.
Haven't finished it. No, Jake and I interviewed RZA. I have not finished it yet. Jake, oh, I actually had a really interesting conversation with RZA about Tarantino. I'll tell you guys about it off.
He loves that type of cinema. But isn't he super into like Asian kung fu
cinema? He and Tarantino are like this.
I'll mention this. I don't mind. It's actually kind of interesting, but I'll just have to tap around because we can't say the word. So we know Quentin Tarantino has been using a certain word in his films early on for a long time. And Spike Lee has, you know, always been very, you know, mad about that specifically. So in Cutthroat City, in RZA's film, so people who don't know, RZA scored, I mean, we all know this. Everyone who listens to the show knows this, but I just say it just in case. But RZA scored Kill Bill. And so him and Quentin Tarantino have been like friends. And obviously Quentin was helping him with the Man with the Iron Fist, which was the movie made by Russell Crowe. And so RZA has a scene in Cutthroat City where there's like a six guys sitting around in the back of a vehicle. And it's his Reservoir Dogs opening. It's like it's essentially like a circled around shot of like six guys talking, and the characters start talking about Reservoir Dogs and how Quentin Tarantino uses that word way too much in his films. And then one of the guys goes, "Ah, Reservoir Dogs is overrated." And so like, and so I watched the scene. I'm like, okay, maybe this is a good way for me to be able to ask RZA about like does he find it? As a black man, does he find it offensive that Quentin Tarantino uses those words? And he gave me this phenomenal answer about like Quentin Tarantino being like the most genuine dude ever, so much so that he would invite RZA's brother, his 6'5" brother, over to spend the night at his house and watch movies with him. And he went through this entire amazing answer about like defending Quentin Tarantino, basically saying that like he's an artist. He's essentially using the words that the characters would say. And I just thought it was really interesting to hear RZA talk about that because, you know, you think about all the negative criticism. I mean, Jake, you brought it up with Samuel L. Jackson. But it is interesting. And so my question to RZA was, do you think Quentin's going to be mad at you for this joke? And he went on this amazing answer about why he wouldn't be mad and like essentially defending Quentin Tarantino against any type of allegations like that that he would be considered racist for using words. Now, I just thought that was a really cool thing that he did. He made the joke in the movie. He brought it to the attention of the audience, but it was in a playful way. But it was also he defended his friend. And I thought that was really cool. So
are you going to have that on your YouTube channel?
Yeah, I'll pop it up on YouTube. Like he was really interesting. I grew up listening to an album he made called Bobby Digital. It was a 1998 album. It was a sci-fi record he made. And so we got into that a little bit. I mean, I don't know if people are interested in that. It's a hip hop album, but I loved it.
That's cool.
So.
Very nice.
Yeah, I love RZA. I mean, RZA's music has always been cinematic. Think about it. Like Wu-Tang Clan, 36 Chambers, all that stuff comes from movies. Wu-Tang Clan's based on a movie called Shaolin Wu-Tang, I think is the name of the film. The name of their group comes from a kung fu film. And that's why all their music is so cinematic, though. Anyways.
That's awesome. Very cool. All right, let's get on to this week's blend game. We are playing hashtag Russell Crowe blend to go along with Unhinged. And just the fact that Russell Crowe is a really great guy who did interviews with the guys so far today. Not today, but over the course of promoting Unhinged. You can go to their YouTube channels and find each of those. So let's get into our picks. And I'm going to throw it to Jake. Your favorite Russell Crowe film.
I could not pick anything other than Gladiator.
Really?
I just think it is, one, an incredible performance on his part that covers a vast wide range of emotions. Like he's a little bit more subdued and low-key, but still is able to elicit so many. I mean, like when his vengeful feeling whenever he comes eye to eye with Commodus for the first time since becoming a slave, his the travesty of his wife and son being brutally murdered, the love that he has for the Caesar, for Richard Harris at the beginning of the film. It's a very subdued performance, but even within that performance is able to touch on so many different emotions. And just the film itself, I think Ridley Scott does an incredible job of bringing this world to life. Obviously, Sword and Sandal epic, something that's been around for decades, but I felt like it's the most accessible and the best it's been done sort of within, you know, modern era. My girlfriend and I recently rewatched it to get ready for the interview with Russell, and I think it holds up incredibly well 20 years later. It's both an enjoyable film, but also just really a high constructed piece of art. And I love it. And there are a lot of other films that he's been in that I genuinely love. But in terms of, I mean, this is really my usage of the word favorite. I just love it. I love
it. This one was really hard to do. He's got so many great films. Kev, did you pick Gladiator also?
No, I did A Beautiful Mind, and I've explained it on the show before, so I won't like take too much time with it. But it's just a film that I heavily relate to because of the mental aspect of it. And I've been in therapy all my life, and one of the things I've always talked about was a scene from that movie. And I've mentioned it on the show before, but I'll just briefly mention it again in case someone new is listening. But there's a moment at the end of that film. If you remember, the whole film is him struggling with the mental illness and that he's going through, and he's obviously seeing things. Paul Bettany's character, and then there was this great moment at the end of the film, which is like to this day the thing that I hope I can achieve before I die, which is to be able to walk past the mental illness for a moment and push through with your life, because for with mental illness and mental health. I don't want to call it a mental illness. I feel like that's the wrong word to use. I'm going to say mental health. But, there's a big stigma around it. People don't talk about it as much. But Beautiful Mind really put that on the map. And in regards to, showing a character his struggle and what he was going through. But in that film, at the end, as he walks past Paul Bettany, and Bettany tries to kind of get his attention, right, to kind of pull him back into that world. And I think Crow just continues walking right past him, right? And... Like, I always tell my therapist, that's what I tell my therapist every time I talk, not every time, but every couple weeks, I'll bring up that scene and I'll say, that's where I want to get. Like, how do I get there? Because, with me, with OCD and anxiety, it's paralyzing. It paralyzes you. Mentally, it's hard to push through your day. It's hard to push through, it's hard for me to come home sometimes and, be a good husband because I'm so in my own worries and anxieties from driving and whatever it would be. And so I always look at that moment as like, all right, he was really, really dealing with some horrible mental health issues, right? I mean, it was getting bad. That character's going through something a lot worse than what my own mental state is with OCD and things like that. But to see his character, which is a true story, right? Obviously, it's based on a true story.
Yeah, John Nash.
To see John Nash like just walk past with that confidence. And I remember... One thing my therapist told me years ago was basically the OCD and the anxieties are always going to be in my mind. They're not going to go away. It's just because I have a chemical imbalance. But you can choose how you're going to react to it. And for the longest time, John Nash's character is so weak in himself that he doesn't have confidence in himself that he allows it to take over, hurts his marriage, obviously. And so for me, that film meant a lot just on a personal level because it showed me a victory of somebody who went through something really bad, but still was able to acknowledge that it was there and move past it. And I know, and here's the thing, at the end of the day, everyone's going to fall back. Everyone's going to fall back into the worries and the anxieties. And, maybe the next day he does stop and go over to Paul Bettany in his mind, right? But it was just a really inspiring story and obviously gorgeously photographed and shot by, directed by Ron Howard, and Jennifer Connelly is outstanding. Remember Connelly in the bathroom when she screams that it was in the trailer. I think she's in front of a mirror or something. Yeah. It was this insane scream. I just gut wrenching.
If I remember, it's just because she got so fed up with it. She reached her breaking point of dealing with him.
Exactly. And that's the sad thing about mental health when you see it. Now you're seeing it in a film form there, but it's not just the person going through it, it's the person surrounding that person as well, whoever and so while his was way more extreme than mine is, I just always looked at it as a really interesting way to maybe see a clear path past the anxiety. So
that's amazing, dude. That's a why great I love that story. Film. Yeah. I don't even want to go.
I think I've told it before. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I
so,
don't want
to. So Sean, tell me. Tell me why you love the nice guys.
Oh, God. It's awful. Mine's LA Confidential, if only because... Oh, I love that genre, and I've discussed this at length, that I love detective crime stories. I love things set in the film noir world. I'm obsessed with Los Angeles and Hollywood, and that has the element of the prostitutes who are reworked into famous film stars so that they could be paired up with Johns. And then it's got this terrific twist in the middle of it, which I won't give away. The Rollo Tomasi hook that allowed Kevin Spacey to get the upper hand. It's one of those ones too, where the ensemble is so fantastic. So I don't really want to call it a Russell Crowe film, although he's significant to it, but everyone in it is fantastic. I like that it came sort of at the earlier stages of his career where nobody quite knew how good Russell Crowe was going to be yet. And he's so talented, he doesn't let himself get typecast to just play sort of bruiser cops, which he probably could have played for a decade after LA Confidential, but instead he shows up in movies like Master and Commander or something as subtle as Beautiful Mind. I it's funny looking over his filmography. I kind of thought that we were wasting Russell Crowe's good years, but it turns out he's been consistent still all the way through. Like Nice Guys was still relatively recently. And yes, he's taken things like Unhinged, but I think he has another tremendous performance, you know, in a really noteworthy film. Well, Les Mis was relatively recently. And so, he's fantastic, but I would go for favorite film of his. I would, if you're telling me to pull one of his films out of the shelf and throw it in, I'm going to go LA Confidential just about every single time. So audience picks, Dante and Amanda Young went with Kevin and said A Beautiful Mind. Ray Perkin and Carter went with me and said LA Confidential. Joel McFarlane went with Jake and said Gladiator. Terry Tingren and Braden Roberts, who works at Cinema Blend, went 310 to Yuma.
Great movie.
Terrific film. Carrie Case, Wicket Liu, and Josh went with The Nice Guys. And then John Palmer chose The Insider. The Insider is one of those movies that I have to revisit. Oh. I mean, I remember loving it, but it's not. It's a movie that I just haven't gone back to see in a really, long time.
One of Pacino's last great performances, and it was like 20 years ago.
I need to go back and rewatch
Gabe, what would you pick?
Gabe hates playing this game.
Yeah, I don't play this game.
But you gotta have one, man.
I don't have one. I like him in a lot of things. I don't play the game.
It's awful.
I direct the game. I don't play the game.
It's awful that Gary. Well, speaking of directing the game, Gabe is telling us that for next week, we're going to be playing hashtag Octavia Spencer Blend. So you will use hashtag Octavia Spencer Blend to let us know your pick, and we will potentially read it on the show. You can also email us your pick at realblend@cinemablend.com. That is a place where you can also send us a review. And this week's review comes to us from Duke National Champion, which right off the bat, I don't like you because I'm a Tar Heel fan. Sorry, no pun intended. The subject line is best movie podcast ever. And this is a long one, so I'm going to settle in and take a stretch and get into this one. It says there are levels of movie fandom. The casual moviegoers who will go see movies once in a while.
I like this review already.
Those who go regularly to the theaters, and those who go to early screenings, line up for a premiere on opening night, and collect Blu-rays and memorabilia, and can talk for hours with other movie fanatics. If you are like me and part of the last group, this podcast is for you. It's made with passion from hardcore movie fans for movie fans. It is by far one of the most enjoyable podcasts I have listened to, and let me tell you why. Real Blend is a fascinating exploration of not only upcoming movie news, but also a glimpse behind the scenes of movie journalism. The Real Blend team of Sean, Kevin, and Jake, and Gabe behind the scenes are seasoned entertainment journalists who already do this every day for their job. You may have seen their interviews on the red carpet and YouTube, but every week, together on this podcast, they share the latest news on upcoming movies, interview some of the most talented filmmakers in great depth, and engage in heated debates in their movie reviews. What I love about their reviews is that they feel fresh, unbiased, and often they have wildly different opinions. This podcast and its community has become like a secret handshake amongst the movie fanatics. That is awesome.
Love that line.
That's awesome.
It's a great line. I have a great deal of respect of what these gentlemen have done, and it looks like they're only getting started as their popularity continues to grow. Congratulations on your 100th episode, and here's to many more to come. P.S. I wanted to share a personal anecdote to an interaction with Kevin. In March of 2017, I was in Austin for the South by Southwest Film Festival and on the red carpet trying to get Ryan Reynolds to sign my Deadpool poster.
Oh, Kevin, I know who this is.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah, I remember this. I had no idea this was the guy you were reading. Okay, keep going.
He says, Kevin, along with the rest of the press, were inches away from me in the red carpet area interviewing Ryan, Jake, and the rest of the cast. This was for Life, right? They were there for?
Yeah.
I remember Kevin being very friendly and even waving Ryan over to sign my poster, which he did. So thank you, Kevin. Then he says, I also met my friend Kalina, who is part of the Real Blend family, at South by Southwest, and she introduced me to this podcast. See how movies bring everyone together. That's an awesome,
great review. Great review. Love that secret handshake line.
Yeah, you remember doing that, Kev? You
waved Brian Reynolds on? And the only reason I remember it is I remember that that same person, I think, sent me a message. Not like, I don't remember, like maybe like a year or so ago, thanking me for that. And I remembered it now because Reynolds is such a nice guy, and like, and he was being bombarded. And I had already interviewed him that day at the junket, and then again on that carpet. And I don't know what it was, but he looked over. This guy was standing there, and I remember I think it's on Facebook Live. I was on Facebook Live when it happened. There's a video of it, and like Reynolds was like, "Yeah, I'll come over." He came over and he met the guy. It was like really nice thing. I mean, he didn't have to do it. But I mean, I didn't really do anything. I was just there, and I was just like, hey, can you sign this guy's thing? That's all I said. I didn't do anything.
Well, thank you very much for the review. That is an awesome one. If you guys want to get your reviews read on the show, send them to realblend@cinemablend.com, the email address, and we will hopefully read it on the next episode. So for next week, I want to tease the premium episode that we're going to be recording immediately after this. It will be a Real Blend show question and answer, audience grab bag. You guys sent in some questions. We are going to answer them. That will be made available on the premium episode, which is available on Mondays. And next week, I will have another newsletter for you guys too, because I believe it's bi-weekly, right, Gabe?
Bi-weekly.
That's correct. Yeah, there we go.
Next Friday.
So you can listen to us when the shows, multiple shows drop. Remember to go over to the YouTube channels and give us a follow and hit the subscribe and like buttons while you're there. Go to social media and follow us at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, and at Sean_O'Connell. Drop us a review on iTunes. And tune in for next week's episodes where maybe we will have seen Christopher Nolan's film Tenet. If it happens. Hashtag if it happens. So until then.
If you guys do, though, I will. I'll just have to stop producing the show until I see it. So
we will tell you every detail.
I'll just let you guys handle it.
Next week's episode where we recap every minute of Tenet for Gabe to listen to.
And it's a 14-hour long episode because we don't have anyone to tell us to wrap.
Thank you, guys. Talk to you next week.
Funniest tweets I saw, by the way, of the Travis Scott thing was that he's going to be rapping backwards.
If anyone could do it, it would be him.
That would be amazing. All right, Dunkirk. All right.
Dunkirk.
Grand Canyon University makes earning your degree possible with over 130 academic programs for traditional campus students, with more than 80 bachelor's programs offered online. GCU provides you with the personal support you need, from complimentary unofficial transcript evaluations within 24 business hours to scholarships, academic support, and your GCU graduation team, led by your own university counselor. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.